In a few moments. Okay, we're recording right now. Hello, guys. Podcast. Today, we are back once again talking to Professor Kevin McDonald. Professor Kevin McDonald is Professor Emeritus of Psychology at California State Long Beach. He received his master's in evolutionary biology. He received his his PhD in behavioral science in the University of Connecticut. He's a published author of such books like The Culture of Critique, Separation of and Its Discontents, and The People That Shall Dwell Alone, and is also the editor of the Occidental Observer. Welcome back, Kevin. It's really nice to have you here.
Yes, it's nice to talk to you again. Been a while.
It's been quite a while. I hope you are doing fine and you are doing great. Listen, Kevin, one of the things that I'd like to talk to you about today, I think that you are the right person to do so, because the topic that we're going to talk about oftentimes gets down a slippery slope of tropes and disrespect, and we'd like to do it in a very, and you're the right person to do it in the most adequate, respectful, and an academic way, which is something that has always characterized you. Recently, there's been an uprising in the Middle East with Hamas and Israel. There's fights, there's deaths. It's coping all over the headlines in the United States, yet the United States is marred by its own problems. However, it is my appreciation that somehow what's going on in Israel and then in its borders seems to be far more important than the problems that the United States is facing. An opioid epidemic, a withdrawal from a war that lasted longer than the Vietnam War, that was the Afghanistan occupation of the the US occupation of Afghanistan. There's problems with the economics there, and yet somehow the media and its talking heads seem to point the narrative towards a faraway land, towards a faraway people and a group that has enough resources and has enough power to stand up for itself. So I'd like to start our conversation by asking you, what is your opinion on these current events?
Yes, well, it's a huge story in America, obviously, and it's really a sort of awesome display of Jewish power in America, because, the media is typically presenting only one side of this, the pro-Israel side. Our political culture, with the exception of some people on the far left, like four or five representatives in the House of Representatives, and actually 15. Yeah, exactly. Ilhan Omar, Jayapal, Rachel Tlaib, who's Palestinian, and those kind of people, Cori Bush, because that the skeptics of it about Israel really now are on the left. I mean, in the mainstream culture, there are people like me on the right, but not very many. And you look at the mainstream conservative media, and it's like gung-ho for Israel. And they just condemn Hamas out of hand. And they completely ignore the context. I mean, they just talk about, well, this was barbaric, what Hamas did. They don't talk about the fact that Gaza is an open-air prison, that they've been having an embargo on Gaza for the last 17 years. And so they only let essentials in. Basically, the people are on a low-level starvation diet. They've had flare-ups every few years, bombing them and all that. That's completely ignored. They completely ignore what's going on in the West Bank, that they've kept stealing land and pushing the Palestinians into these little enclaves. And the settlers are extremely aggressive over there. And even since the war, we always talk about the casualties in Gaza. Well, 150 Palestinians have been killed on the West Bank since the war began, because there are a lot of protests over there, and the Israelis deal with them very harshly. So you throw stones at a Israeli military position or something, and they will shoot you. Even in the Gaza, I mean, they would have these Gazans approaching the fence between Israel and Gaza, and they would just shoot them. Peaceful protests don't work with these people. You could do all kinds of, you know, Gandhi-type protests and sit-ins and all that. It doesn't dent Israeli consciousness, because they will simply do things. I mean, I read that if you have a sit-in type of protest, they will pour stinking fluid on you and do horrible things. So it's a brutal regime that's never mentioned in this conservative media, especially, but also to a substantial extent with the liberal media. Because if you look at the House of Representatives, I mean, out of 435 members, only 15 did not vote for the Israeli position, and in the Senate, it was unanimous. So, we're in bad shape. As you say, we've just gotten out of these two long wars. Now people are talking about a wider war that Hezbollah in the north is increasing clashes there. American troops are being attacked in Syria. And Iraq, and you know, Iran is making threats, talking about red lines and all that. I don't know. And when push comes to shove, what's Russia going to do? Are they going to stick with Iran? They sort of allied with Iran. It's just a very dangerous situation. But, Israel seems to be pushing ahead, full speed ahead, and ignoring all this. They seem to want revenge. They've already killed, you know, 5-6 times as many Palestinians as Palestinians killed the Israelis. And by the way, there's a lot of doubt about who killed who on the west, on the outside the Gaza fence on October 7th. Yes. Because a lot of people, there's a lot of evidence from Israelis and testimony that Israeli defense forces fired almost indiscriminately and blew up houses, which Palestinians didn't even have the equipment to do. And basically were panicked and shot hostages and everything. So a lot of those casualties were undoubtedly by the IDF. But of course, that's never mentioned either in the mainstream media. That's, you have to search for that online.
Of course.
Yeah. So that's the state of affairs here. And it's an awesome display of Jewish power. And the other thing that's happening is that these Jewish billionaires are refusing to give money to universities unless they unequivocally condemn Hamas and voice support for Israel. And there have been student groups, a lot of student groups are Palestinians and Muslims and leftists who really deplore Israel. And they have signed petitions. Well, they're getting blacklisted from jobs by these billionaires who won't hire them and are insisting that they have a sort of blacklist of these people. They're pressuring university administrators at the University of Pennsylvania. This billionaire threatened, he'd given $50 million to the University of Pennsylsylvania, so he's very wealthy.
And he has an auditorium with his name on it, too.
Yeah, that's what happens. And but now he's saying that they got to fire the president and the head of the board of trustees. And that's huge pressure. I mean, these billionaires are the people that keep those universities going with these huge endowments. I mean, Harvard probably has, I don't know, $50, $60 billion in their endowment. They're incredibly wealthy. But a lot of that comes from these donors. And they're saying, we're not going to contribute anymore. So huge pressure on the university and on the students who want to keep their nose clean. I mean, they're ambitious. They want to make a lot of money. They have to watch it.
I find it incredibly ironic that what you're saying from the perspective of academia, that all these universities that are being funded by a lot of billionaires that have this ethno-religious identification, they have a strong group identification as Jews. They give money to these universities. They form and they form these students with a corpus of teachers that are ideologically aligned to the left. And now all these students, like you said, are merely expressing and echoing what they learned from their teachers. And now all of a sudden, these things in the Middle East break out, and all these ideologized students break out in protests in favor of what is quote unquote America's greatest ally in the region. And now you find yourself with this event that all these woke billionaires, Jewish woke billionaires, are not willing to give out money to these universities. I as a Venezuelan, watching things from outside, is sort of like the that fable of the scorpion and the frog, if you know where I'm coming from.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
So this psychologically intense and relentlessly intense covering every possible angle in the of the Hamas Israel crisis, as you pointed out in the media, only like you said, only a few Congress people in the and representatives have voiced against it, against what's going on. I believe they even passed the Senate, or that your legislative branch in the United States even passed unanimously a law condemning anti-Semitism in campuses. Now, what I would like to ask you is, how is it that they are conflating, by which psychological mechanisms are these people capable of conflating the criticism of Israeli foreign and domestic policy with what anti-Semitism it really is? Why is that? How is this conflation possible? Is there a psychological aspect to this? Is this something that just came out, or is this something that needs that is just a mere coincidence, Professor?
Well, it's something that is part of the sort of Jewish propaganda, because at least partly that is to say that for a long time Jewish organizations will say, well, you can criticize Israel, but that's not any Semitism necessarily. And they distinguish that between criticizing Jews or Jewish power or something like that. But you could criticize Israel, but now they are conflating that. And it's been a few years now, but it hasn't been that long. There used to be a way to criticize Israel, but now they've sort of clamped down, and because they know that Israel is violates all the modern Western moral ethical tradition, that Western cultures pride themselves on ethnic diversity, and they pride themselves on human rights and all that. Israel doesn't believe in any of that. They pride themselves on open immigration. Israel doesn't believe in that. And so there's this, you criticize Israel for any of those things, human rights violations, which everybody does. It's an apartheid state, segregation, ethnic cleansing, and it's really hard for people who are defending Israel to stand up to that, even though they do, because it's so obviously true. And so they've now conflated that. If you talk about that, that's that's anti-Semitism. And that has more of a sort of fallback position, if you will. It's a fallback position that they feel they're on good, you know, strong position with, because, you know, then they start invoking the Holocaust. And how many times did you see the Holocaust mentioned after October 7th? Because they kept saying this is the most Jews killed in any event since the Holocaust. And Holocaust. And so, again, the American public has been so inundated with this kind of Holocaust propaganda that they, you know, they automatically side with Israel. And then, you know, there are other reasons why America does that. I mean, you've got these Christian evangelicals who think that if Israel totally wins over there, that it'll bring on the second coming of Jesus and that they'll all go to heaven. Which, you know, seems crazy to me. They're being manipulated by Israel and by Jews in this country. That's the way it is. And as usual, Jewish activism, you know, involves money, for first of all. I mean, we talked about the Jewish billionaires. Jewish activism involves media power. Jews still own an awful lot of media in this country, and they have huge influence. As I say, the conservative media is unanimously in favor of Gaza. You might think that's surprising, but it's not. They are far more, you know, uncritical of Israel than sort of mainstream liberal. If you look at the New York Times, they will have, you know, a fairly balanced coverage. They don't include a lot of things. They are Jewish and all that, but they acknowledge that there are, you know, they have different perspectives in the New York Times. So it involves media power, political power via donations. You know, they have APEC, the American Israel Public Affairs Committee. They got a lot of money. And they, all these congressmen and senators are terrified of getting on the wrong side of APEC, because an awful lot of money will go to their opponents, and they will do their best to get him out of there. People like Ilhan Omar, she's in a safe district. Ocasio-Cortez is a safe district. They've tried to run people against them, but have not succeeded. But in general, it's very effective. Politicians are terrified of the Israel lobby and the money that it involves and the media exposure and everything else. So that's the power. And as you say, it's from all angles. And it's from 24/7, you know, what we call a full court press. You know, it's like they pull out all the stops, very intensive. And right now we're seeing an awful lot of that, you know, this intense Jewish activism, which is, you know, subsides quite a bit during normal times. But something like this, it flares up and you can really see it. And it's useful in that regard. I hope a lot of Americans wake up. Unfortunately, a lot of Americans, you know, they're nice people, they're sort of liberal and all human rights and all that. And, you know, they sort of ignore Israel for the most part. But this happens and it produces a sort of cognitive dissonance, you might say. They can't process it very well. But when they do process it, say, well, Israel's really overreacting here. They're ignoring all the evil that Israel does to the Palestinians. But they never talk about Jewish power in this country as causing the problem, because Israel wouldn't be doing any of this if they didn't have the United States behind them. And you have to wonder, anybody rationally would think, well, you know, I should look at Jewish power in America as partly explaining it, in large part explaining this. They don't do that. They refuse to go there because that's anti-Semitism. You talk about Jewish power in America, boy, they will come down on you as they have come down on me and other people, you know, with these ideas. That's the way that the system works.
Thank you for that that explanation. And that brings me to my next question. You know, I all of the time I hear from politicians, I hear from the military, I hear from government officials in the United States that their alliance that the United States and Israel has with each other, you know, that they're their strongest ally. But from what I can see, from the perspective I have as a foreigner, looking from a different perspective, looking from through a different lens, what, in your opinion, does your country get back from Israel from all the help and all the money and all the aggressiveness and all the psychologically intense movements that these elites, so to say, push in the United States? Because what I perceive is that sometimes the actions that the United States, that the instructions that the United States gives to the Israelis when it comes to deals, alliances, and what have you, seem to go the other way. Take, for example, during the Obama administration, Barack Obama and Joe Biden demanded Israel not to expand the settlements. Israel went and expanded the settlements. During the Trump years, Trump told the Israelis not to push on that much on the settlement issue again, and they did, again. And not to mention how the intervention during the Trump administration of Trump's son-in-law Kushner was involved in Saudi Arabia, Jordan, and the surrounding Arab countries, which now have a good have established good relationships with Israel. But in the gist, what's the gist of it? What does your country get back from Israel from all the money that you and many other taxpayers are giving them in return? You know, what do you get back?
What do we get back? A feeling of doing their bidding, I guess. I mean, as you say, it's trillions of dollars that we've wasted in the war in Iraq, the war in Afghanistan. We got nothing out of it, finally withdrew. And now, you know, we support Israel. I've heard 16 to 20% of their military budget. Now President Biden wants more money for Israel. Wants to quadruple it, basically, up to like $14 billion, because of this crisis. So it never ends. And we've had, you know, thousands of American soldiers killed, many more wounded grievously. You know, they get these bombs and they can save their lives, but their brain is missing. They have missing legs and arms, and it's horrible.
Mental illnesses as well, yeah, PTSD, right, and what have you.
Exactly. So we have suffered tremendously from this. And of course, Biden is all in on this most recent one, as all these other presidents would be. I mean, we are totally under lockdown from these people. We have no power anymore. we don't get anything out of it, really. And as you say, that Israel has defied the United States any number of times. Israel has spied on the United States. There's exactly. all these Israelis who've been or American citizens who family in Israel, they're oftentimes dual citizens. They've been accused of spying. And it never goes anywhere because the prosecution just falls apart because of political pressure. So this is the power that the Jewish community has in this country. And it's, you know, there are Jews who dissent from this. You know, there's something called Jewish Voice for Peace. There's a website called Mondo Weiss, and they have good stuff. I mean, they run both Jewish sites. And they're proudly Jewish and all that, but they completely disagree with this.
Haredim Jews as well.
Yeah. But the fact is that where the power is, where the money is all for Israel. And we see an upsurge in Jewish activism, and because of the crisis, the Jews always become more active when they think there's a threat to Israel or Jewish interests anywhere. And speaking of the Haredim, you know, these soldiers in these Orthodox, ultra-Orthodox Haredim in Israel would refuse to serve in the military. Well, all of a sudden they're volunteering because of this crisis. And so you see an upsurge in Jewish identity and Jewish feeling and is pouring out everywhere. But boy, it's not going to end well, I tell you.
I see. Well, this has been a very good and broadly explaining a very good explanation. Thank you for that, Professor Kevin. I would like now to pivot to another thing, which is your book, the one that you published in 2019, Individualism and the Western Liberal Tradition, Evolutionary Origins, History, Prospects for the Future. I got a copy of it. I read it. I found it extremely interesting because I learned a few things that I didn't know about the society that is studied in your work. For our listeners, could you briefly tell us a little bit about this latest work of yours, what brought you to it, and give us the broad strokes, if you wouldn't mind, please?
Yes, it's a book about the West. Western Europe is unique in many ways. And I go into the anthropology, the early origins of Western Europe. There's really three different peoples in Europe, in Northern Europe, Northwestern Europe, sort of Central Europe, and then the Southern Europe. And they come from different origins prehistorically. And in the book, I talk about especially two of them, the Indo-European culture, which basically conquered almost, all the known world. They went all the way over to China, down to India. They dominated India. And they are a very successful group. But also, Indo-European cultures like Rome and Greece. And then in the European Middle Ages, the Germanic culture was very Indo-European. The other culture is sort of Northwestern European, Scandinavian. And the Indo-European culture is very hierarchical, but at the same time, it's not despotic. It's a militarized culture, completely militarized. And you can see that in Rome as well, as this offshoot of Indo-European culture. But in the far north, it was more egalitarian and hunter-gatherer type of culture. Those two cultures are the most influential, I think, in Europe. And so I go through it. I talk about the Catholic Church, the influence of the Catholic Church in the Middle Ages, especially. And because the Catholic Church promoted individualism, they broke up the kinship groups and all that. And the kinship groups are the opposite of Western individualism. Individualists don't have strong kinship relations. They don't have extended families. You go to the Middle East and that's what you see, these extended families. The West has conquered the Middle East several times. Like the Greeks went there, the Romans then went there, and as soon as they're gone, it just reverts to the Middle Eastern culture, which is tribal, basically. And it's the roots of Judaism. Very ethnocentric, very kinship oriented, collectivist, as we say, the opposite of individual. There's a lot of people now agree that Western culture is unique in all the world. The basic uniqueness has to do with kinship relations and family relations. And I've been studying Western families since the 1980s and marriage practices and so on. So I finally put it together in the book, 2019. And relevant to our discussion that we're talking about with Jewish activists and everything, I do talk about the rise of the Jews, beginning in the late 19th century, especially. Now, they were somewhat influential before that, but after the Enlightenment, Jews became quite powerful, and you started to see the rise of a different kind of anti-Jewish writing, where they were focused on Jewish financial power, Jewish power in the media, and that sort of thing. not talking about, you know, Jews killed Christ or something like that. They talked about Jewish economic power and their power, especially in the media and universities and all that. And that has increased. And in America in particular, you know, at the turn of the century, Jews were flocking into America, like three million Jews at least, from Eastern Europe in general. They tend to be Orthodox and really seriously Jewish, but also a lot of Jewish radicals, political radicalism and Zionism. So they, you know, different strands of it going on, oftentimes in the same person, politically radical, but Zionist and all that, strong Jewish identification. And so that's what really changed, you know, that Jewish power reached its peak, I think, in the United States, and it's still probably increasing, I don't know. But it's it gradually increased. Now, before World War II, they did not have that much power. Like in 1924, there was a huge battle over immigration, and the Jews lost because America wanted to stay white, and they wanted to stay European. They didn't want to have immigration from all over the world. You had this Jewish intellectual.
Uh-huh. Go ahead. Sorry for interrupting. I'll ask my question after this.
Yeah, they didn't want all that immigration. And so they shut off immigration from the rest of the world. They biased the immigration system toward Western Europe, Northwestern Europe in particular. And but that didn't last long. I mean, and Jewish activists were, you know, chomping at the bit. They were doing all they could to overcome that for many years. And then in 1965, they won that war.
With the Teddy Kennedy Act, right?
Yeah, well, he was sort of the spokesman, but the pressure and all the money and activism came from Jews and Jewish organizations. Ted Kennedy was sort of a figurehead. He was a young senator, has been in the Senate for a year or two. And he gets his name on it, but it was a done deal. He didn't do anything, really. That's what really changed America, is that immigration law. And immigration has increased. And so the constant pressure to increase the numbers. And now with the Biden administration, they're not only admitting about a million legal immigrants every year, but they're putting in millions, literally millions of illegal immigrants, many from Venezuela, by the way, but also from Mexico and Central America and Africa, everywhere in the country, everywhere in the world, these immigrants are flowing in. So early in the 20th century, Jews didn't have that much power, but they gradually gained more and more power. After World War II, they exploded. They already had a lot of media power. They owned all the TV stations and the movie studios and all that. They were rising in the academic world. Huge influx of Jewish professors in the 1960s. And it changed America. It was a top-down kind of top-down revolution, starting from the top of society, from the wealthy, the powerful, the influential, down. And so I talk about that in one of the chapters in my book, but I also talk about the sort of moral basis of Western culture, that Western cultures are not based on kinship, as I was saying, but they are based on moral communities. That is, your reputation as a good person, as someone you can trust, someone you can do business with, is critical. And so Western cultures uniquely really don't value kinship that much. And people hire the best person for the job. Whereas in Africa or other, the Middle East and all that, you hire your relatives. And you don't necessarily try to get the best person. You try to help your relatives. And so there's a lot of corruption in those countries. Whereas Western cultures have been relatively free of corruption. Historically, but the problem is now that these moral communities are established by the media. That is, what's good and what's bad is established by the media. And as I was saying, Jews have a huge position in American media and the Western media generally, and so they use that to basically say that if you oppose immigration, you're a racist, you're a bad person. And
you're morally flawed.
They're morally flawed. And you see these Westerners, and especially women. Women just don't want to feel that they're bad people. They want to have a good reputation. They want people to like them. And that's a basic part of
that's inherent to their psychology, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, that's what I argue in chapter 8 of the book, that this is a basic thing about Western culture, that the social glue of Western cultures are the sort of public sense of reputation, being a good person. But now, if you oppose Israel, you're a bad person. If you oppose immigration, you're a bad person. If you oppose Black Lives Matter, you're a bad person. So all these things come together.
You sort of post in your book that somehow the Western, I'm going to use a pop culture reference from Jim Morrison. Jim Morrison once said, once wrote, the West is the best, you know? So in that sense, in your book, you sort of post that the moral stance of Western cultures is sort of moral universalism, that morality is independent of group affiliation, so to say. If I'm interpreting what I took from your book correctly, I have a couple of questions concerning what you just covered. Okay. You know, back in the 1920s, the 1930s, you know, like you said, Jews were a very small proportion of immigrants. They were radically Jewish. Some of them were very highly Orthodox. They had a high in-group. They stuck within themselves. And back in those days, you know, the 1920s, the 1930s, they couldn't get into a country club. They were I don't know if they could. They had the same access to higher education in the universities. I'm not really familiarized with that, but I do believe there wasn't a quota, or there was something within the admissions to the universities regarding Jews. Jews in that sense. What the WASP, white Anglo-Saxon America, sort of shunned them, and this took this radical turn in the 1960s, like you explained. However, looking back, and I've been studying the history of your country in the first couple of decades of the 20th century, I noticed that there's a U.S. president in particular in those years that had a much more open stance towards Jewish minorities, and that was Woodrow Wilson. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I think he was the first one who even nominated the first Jew into the Supreme Court. Or
that's right.
Maybe it was something else. Does that retrotract? Was that sort of an introduction of what came after, history wise, Professor?
Yeah, well, what you're saying is right. I mean, Woodrow Wilson nominated Brandeis for the Supreme Court, and he was confirmed. You got to realize Brandeis was an open Jewish activist. He was like a prominent Zionist. And he was like, he's liberal on sort of on the left, in Supreme Court rulings. And it's one thing to nominate a Jew who at least tries to say, I'm not radically Jewish and all that. But here you had this Jew on the Supreme Court who was just fanatically Zionist. Instead of a precedent, I suppose. I mean, ever since then, there has been at least one Jew on the Supreme Court. And it got up to three, and it would have been four if Merrick Garland had been confirmed. If you believe that, four Jews and a nine-member Supreme Court. It would have been astounding, but three is a huge number. Now, Bader Ginsburg died, so there's only two now. But still, I mean, the Jews are like 2% of the population. Why are we doing this. Well, they are an elite, and you know, that's where the money comes from, and all these politicians are enthralled to them. So that's the problem with the American political system.
Correct me if I'm wrong. The number of magistrates in your Supreme Court is 9, 7.
That's right. Nine.
It's nine. Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, so having three or four, it would be. I understand it. Not only are they a demographic minority, but they would entirely overrepresent and push on their agenda according to group evolutionary strategy when it comes to exercising common law when cases are presented to them. They will push their interest, they will push their agendas, they will push what's good for them, not what's good for the entirety of the administration of justice. If I try to understand what you are trying to put out.
I would say that's basically right. I mean, a lot of issues that come before the Supreme Court aren't really related to Jewish interests particularly, but you know, there's definitely a left-right split on the Supreme Court, and the Jews have always been on the left, and as they are politically. I mean, 70% of American Jews, at least, vote for the Democratic Party, and that means that you're all in on critical race theory and Black Lives Matter, all these things that the Democratic Party now stands for. And they are, you know, really the financial mainstay of the Democratic Party. A lot of people, around 75% of the money of the Democratic Party comes from Jews. If you look at the Republican Party, it's quite a bit less, but at the same time, it's not negligible. It's like probably 40%. The Republican Jewish Coalition just had a conference in Las Vegas, and the whole thing was Israel. You know, so the Republican Jewish Coalition, they like Nikki Haley. She's a former governor of South Carolina. And the thing is, she's bought and paid for. They bailed her out, her family financial problems and everything. And they give her huge amounts of money to speak at their organizations. And so she is like totally on the side of Israel. And so the Republican Jewish Coalition loves her. But still, Donald Trump is still leading the polls. But God, they are going after Trump like you wouldn't believe it. I can't believe they're going to let him be president. Something will happen to prevent that.
Ganging up on him.
Totally.
That's all I see from the press. There's a huge ganging up on him. That's enough for us to make a whole different another episode, another thing. I know our time is limited, so I'll move on to probably my last question, because it's a broad one, and I want you to take as much time to explain what I am going to ask. In one of your many conferences that's out there, you once talked. You gave out many conferences. Some out are still out there on YouTube, Rumble, Odyssey, what have you. Okay, I'm gonna try and link to my audience the one that I am referring to. No, you know, we've talked, and I realized that after 1965, things changed dramatically. Okay, both demographically for the United States, both in questions of Jewish power, both in questions of Jewish influence. But in one of your lectures, you described what you called psychological mechanisms of dispossession. Weird sort of way, whites did this to themselves. Where and why does this self-hatred, this sort of shoot yourself in the foot attitude, this grammar of self-intolerance with political correctness and all these things, where do they come from? You talk about psychological mechanisms of dispossession, and I would like to give my listeners the broad strokes on that, if you wouldn't mind, Professor.
Well, yeah, as I said, in chapter 8 of my book, Individualism in the Western Liberal Tradition, I talk about the psychological mechanisms of white dispossession. Fundamentally, we've already talked about this moral thing, that this moral communities, the idea of maintaining a good reputation is a fundamental thing about Western culture, and being a moral person according to the sort of community standards. But there are also other things. I mean, personality systems that feed into this. I think people who are conscientious are especially prone to that. I talk about, let me think here. I'm going to get that up if I could. It's a broad topic, but we have to understand this. And as you say, so one thing that we see here is virtue signaling, you know, that sort of sense of righteousness that Western peoples are particularly prone to, you want to show other people that you're a good person. And so we see what we call virtue signaling. And in my chapter 8, I talk about Charles Dickens, where he talks about these people in England at the time, 19th century, who have all this concern about people in Africa and slaves and all of that, but they don't care at all about what's going on in England to poor British children. And we sort of see that now. I mean, the whole propaganda is to be concerned about what's happening to poor Africans or blacks in this country, and no concern about what's happening to whites. And I always wonder how these people process this, because, you know, their own grandchildren are going to suffer. In America now, we have a huge amount of anti-white prejudice and hatred, and we are very prone to that. There's an awful lot of white people who have internalized that. They do think of white culture as evil, that we stole the land from the Indians. The thing is, different cultures have conquered other cultures since time immemorial. It's been going on forever. But white people are uniquely signaled out. Nobody ever talks about the Arabs spreading over the Middle East, the Bantu Africans spreading over Africa, and taking over, and that sort of thing. So there's been displacements all over in human history. We never talk about that, but we talk about white people. Slavery. We talk about white slavery, that whites had slaves in the 19th century.
They don't talk about Muslim slavery or black slavery.
Black slavery is ubiquitous. It's still there in Africa. Muslim slavery lasted for centuries and probably still is existing.
In the native tribes of South America, there was also slavery and a caste system. You couldn't, Aztecs wouldn't let Aztecs from the higher echelons of their class and their caste wouldn't even let the lower members wear certain shades of colors and of dyes, for example. Nobody talks about that.
Yeah, nobody talks about that. Nobody talks about the fact that white people, Europeans, were the only culture that freed the slaves and did so for moral reasons. So I have a whole chapter in that book on individualism, on this moral community that developed, say, in England, especially in the late 18th century and then beginning of the 19th century, had moral revulsion against slavery. Well, where did you ever see that? You know, Muslims never, even if Muslims stopped doing slavery, it wasn't because of some moral revulsion. African, same way. None of those cultures. Chinese, they all had slaves. But white people are singled out. So this is propaganda. And we see here, you know, the sort of distortion of history. In that chapter, I also talk about psychological mechanisms like empathy and link it to personality systems. And I cite some research from Richard Lind that say white people are more empathic, less prone to sociopathy, psychopathy than black people. and that that we've had selection in Europe for empathy and conjugal marriage based on affection. You see that going way back in history. They can't even date when this was origins of this. It's just not common. You look at other cultures, you look at Africa, basically women are bought and sold. And you have as many wives as you can afford. Same in Muslim cultures. Love is really a secondary, third thing. You know, you marry for wealth, you marry for family connections and all that. You don't marry for love and affection. It may happen, but it's way unnecessary. And Western cultures have elevated this to a primary thing. And people wouldn't think of getting married without having some affection for the person they're getting married. Even the upper classes. And, you know, even by the 17th, 18th century, that was extremely common in European upper classes. Again, it just didn't happen elsewhere. Even if you had landed property, you didn't just marry your daughter on that basis. Your daughter wouldn't want to get married and would have some say in it. And so people who are high on this system, it's a psychological system. It's called nurturance, love, in the psychological literature. They are prone to empathy. And so it's very easy for them to be swayed by media images of suffering people. And you see that, like if there's an earthquake in Haiti or suffering in Haiti, and there's always suffering in Haiti. Right now there's total chaos in Haiti. You know, gangs all over the place. They have no civil order. So they'll show pictures of poor starving children. And then you have all these women in America wanting to adopt them and, you know, give them money and all this. Americans are very generous to that sort of thing. But it's pathological at this point. We're hurting ourselves because we're being taken advantage of. And, our good traits are being turned against us. Individualism was made the West what it is. Made our inventiveness, our exploratory sense, our sense of, probing other
art ideas.
Art. You look at Western art, exactly, and that's individualism. That people striving to be good at something,
and aesthetics as a moral imperative.
Absolutely, but that's it's. That is what's being suppressed now because meritocracy is seen as racist because, test scores show that black people don't score as well as white people on standardized tests of any kind, basically, IQ tests in particular. So we're getting beyond affirmative. We're getting beyond any sense of meritocracy in this country. Individualism is seen as racist. Even nuclear families that the West sort of uniquely really emphasized, the lack of the wider kinship group, that is seen as racist. Whereas black families where they don't have any father, those are good. And even though black kids do horribly and they're much higher levels of dropping out of school and crime and all this stuff, but the left just wants to idealize black culture. And so that's what you get. It's pathetic, but that's the way it is.
If I have one more question for you, a brief one, albeit, and thank you for your time once again, Kevin. You have mentioned meritocracy. Meritocracy is a topic that I have read and worked extensively, even during my years as a university professor. Not long ago, there was, I'm not sure if you're familiar with a book called The Tyranny of Meritocracy by Michael Sander. I don't know if you've read about it.
I'm not familiar.
Okay. What he proposes, and it's in this book, He examines the origins of meritocracy, and he poses a philosophical and metaphysical criticism of meritocracy. People on the left say that meritocracy diminishes social capital and social mobility. People on the right say that meritocracy, these are his words, not mine. People on the right say that meritocracy is used to justify the status quo, but in essence, breaks down what meritocracy is. He covers the college admissions problem, the college admissions scandal. He covers how affirmative action is destroying the capacity for aspiring students with capability to enter and what have you. I would like to ask you, what is your opinion on how meritocracy is impacting America's current educational system? And with that, I'd like to wrap things up.
Yeah, meritocracy has always been critical to America's educational system. That's why we have standardized tests. And these tests have been validated in any number of ways. They're linked with IQ and all that. But now they are being thrown out, as I said, because of the disparities between blacks and whites and Latinos. And now Asians scoring higher than whites. That doesn't seem to matter. It's all directed against white people. And, we're going to be in a situation where doctors can barely read and write. I mean, really, they're not, they're heading towards that because it's really a matter of quotas now. And instead of, trying to find qualified blacks, they're going to get blacks at any cost, really, into the upper echelons of the society. And we're already seeing that. I mean, if you look at American television now, you can't see a commercial without black actors. I mean, it's like you'd think that exactly. They were a majority. You think that they were the majority of the country. So this is a thing that we're undergoing now. And a lot of discrimination against white people, especially white males. So you look at the media and oftentimes you'll have, women, the white women are still allowed to have, presence and power. And so you'll see a white, media, white woman hosting a show on National Public Radio and MSNBC, and they'll be interviewing other women. It's almost like a gynecocracy now. But, what's suffering is white men.
And you also see it on children's shows.
Oh, yeah.
And how boys are put in children. I have a small boy, I have a toddler, and I have a really hard time finding some entertainment for him because the boy in the programs and the cultural products that you see out there, the boy is always put out as some sort of bully or incompetent or a brute or portrayed in a negative way.
Yeah, we see that all the time. And, especially blonde-haired men are seen as evil. It's like just a routine. They're the villains. And the Fortune 500 companies, the big companies in America, are not hiring white males much anymore. I mean, they're trying to get their diversity quotas. And there's these investment funds, like a lot of the Jewish money, like BlackRock, Larry Fink, they are pressuring companies to do this diversity thing because they hold stock in the company and they can pressure them that way. And so they are forcing companies to buy into this diversity, equity, inclusion thing that's so common now. So there's huge pressure. And once again, it comes down to Jewish money and power, this time in the financial industry, being able to, influence companies to adopt certain political poses. And that's the way things are now. And then what bothers me is that so many white people are just not tuning into this reality. People who live away from the main areas of immigration, like California, New York City, Chicago, they are still oblivious to it. It doesn't affect their lives much. I live in an area in America where there's not much immigration. You don't see it. You go to a restaurant, you go to a shopping center, you see one or two non-whites in hundreds, but you just don't see very many. But if you go to, New York City, you're going to see thousands and thousands and, millions of them. And they're everywhere. And now they're inundating all these illegals are coming into cities like New York and Chicago. They can't even support them. They have laws in New York City that they have to provide shelter for these illegal immigrants. And they just stop doing it because they don't have enough money. They don't have enough hotels and places to put them. So that's America right now, 21st century, on the ropes. And the left is totally winning. I'm very pessimistic. Some people are talking about secession, that the red states, the more conservative states, should secede from the union. And that would be nice, but it's a long way off. And I just don't see it happening. In the meantime, American politics is completely polarized. People can't talk to one another. My own family won't talk to me, a lot of them. And that's just the way it is. You just have to accept what's happening in America now. And, take it or leave it. You can leave if you want, but it's a terrible situation.
Well, that's a shame to hear. I hope things do get better, because the American society and the American people in general are good, well-intentioned people with, like you described in your book, like you described in this chat, in this podcast, that, they have a lot of things, good things going for them. And there's a lot of people with bad intentions trying to take advantage for them. Well, that's all the time we have for now. I'd like to thank you, Professor, for coming here and taking the time to speak with me. I hope we can do this sometime soon. For the moment, can you tell our audience where can they reach your work? Where can they find your books? Where can they stay in touch with the very valuable material you and your collaborators produce, please?
Yeah, I've got a couple of websites. One is kevinmacdonald.net, MACDONALD.net. And my books are all listed there. My research papers, my articles on Jewish stuff. And I also have a website, OxfamObserver.com. We've had a lot of stuff on the Gaza war, including article I posted yesterday. And I also edit the Occidental Quarterly, which is sort of academic articles. But we need subscribers. And if anybody feels generous, they could subscribe to that. And we'd be very grateful.
Well, that's excellent to know. Once again, Kevin, thank you for the time you had. You had in taking this interview, doing this interview for us, for me and my audience. Once again, we wish you the best. And hopefully we'll see again sometime soon.
Yeah, thank you.